From Colombo, Malaysia, this is Season Podcast.
Welcome to the CSEN podcast. My name is Glenn Taskey, and I'm the Director of Financial Stability and Supervision, Payments and Settlement Systems for the CSEN Center here in Kuala Lumpur. Today, we have special guests. We have Stephen Scott, the founder of Starling Trust Sciences, LLC, and Jeff Kupfer, the co-founder of Starling Trust Sciences. And we're going to talk with you, gentlemen, for the next 40, 45 minutes about managing and mitigating culture and conduct risk in the banking industry and how we can use technology to help in that effort. First off, tell us a little bit about Starling. You know, when and why you founded the company and why the name Starling Trust Sciences, what its principal lines of business are, and what kinds of clients it serves. How did you gravitate towards the field of culture and conduct risk management? Stephen, do you want to start us out?
Sure. Thanks very much, Glenn. Thanks for the opportunity to work with the CSEN Center. Starling is the product of a 25-year career that I had investigating fraud and corruption in large organizations globally. What I saw over and over again in the work that I did over that 25-year period, working on the ground in over 50 countries, was that you see the same movie over and over again. The names and faces may change, but behavior followed certain patterns, and I became adept at identifying those patterns, which made me good at my job. And a few years back, I started thinking to myself, well, if behavior is subject to patterns, then would there not be some way of using technology with a view to identifying those patterns and positioning people to be proactive about managing these risks and identifying them in the first instance? And that's now grown into the business that Jeff and I lead today. We are talked about as a reg tech company, and that is largely a consequence of our choice of the financial services sector as our target customer vertical. In fact of matter, the technology we've developed, which I'll describe later, is actually industry agnostic in its application. But we settled on the financial services sector because we saw that there was an increasing level of regulatory focus to culture and conduct risk, and we thought that our technology might have particular application in that context, and I'll let Jeff say a bit about that. But to your question about the name of the business, there's sort of two pieces to it, Starling and Trust. Well, I guess the third piece is science. the trust piece was actually the first piece that fell into place in my own mind, which was prompted by looking around the world and seeing a complete collapse of trust in most of our major social institutions. And I perceived that that was a real problem. It was a problem that would grow. It was a problem that would have manifest cost. And it occurred to me that if a decline in trust in institutions resulted in costs, then being able to harness and increase trust in institutions could well be a source of value creation, not just for us as a company, but for the customers that we would seek to serve. And the Starling piece came from a video clip I was watching, actually, of someone talking about spontaneous order in nature, and they were looking at a starling murmuration, is what they call those flocks of starlings. They're murmuring is the sound the wings make. And if you've ever seen them, they look like these incredible, complex, multi-organism, but single-entity things. And I started to think that that was a very good metaphor for an organization. And so those two things came together to form Starling Trust.
Very good. Jeff, did you want to comment?
Yeah, I would just say that I came to Starling with a different perspective and background than Stephen, in that I'm a lawyer by training and spent many years in a variety of roles in the U.S. government and the private sector, both in a policy-making role and then in a leadership role of the various organizations. And what I seem to find over and over again is that, especially in a leadership role, you can pronounce a certain directive, you can make a comment, you can put in place some sort of rule or some type of policy, but it's actually what's going on within the organization that is hard to maneuver, hard to change, and sometimes hard to assess. And so the tone from the top that we often hear is not really in and of itself something that drives organizations. It's the echo from the bottom, it's the tone from the middle, it's those variety of factors that actually make an organization effective, and that's what Starling is really all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting, because in bank supervision and regulation, we often talk about substance over form, and we often go into banks, you know, that will have beautifully crafted policies and their allocations of roles between, for example, the three lines of defense are all carefully spelled out. And yet you see that it just doesn't work. It looks beautiful on paper, but when you scratch the surface, there's nothing there. So, you know, your comments are really apt, you know, in the context of the financial services industry, when all of the parts of the bank have to fit together very well, and there has to be trust among all of those different levels within the bank. I want to mention your March 2019 compendium, and I want to highlight that because to me it's one of the most interesting documents that I've read in a long time. You called it Culture and Conduct Risk in the Banking Sector, and you cite a calculation from the Operational Risk Exchange that's both alarming and encouraging. And it's alarming because roughly in the last 10 years, you point out that global fines and settlements related to misconduct totaled over $600 billion. And it's alarming that the frequency and the magnitude of these fines show that the financial services industry has really continued to engage in misconduct well after the great financial crisis seems to have abated. You know, we don't see this misconduct diminishing that much. And so that's alarming. But to me, it's encouraging that the supervisory authorities have at least been fairly active over the past few years in achieving, in essentially trying to hold firms to account. Now tell me, in your opinion, are these big fines and settlements against firms effective in achieving meaningful corrective action? We still keep seeing the bad behavior. Perhaps fines do not achieve corrective action. Maybe we have to move to tougher action. Why haven't the supervisory authorities, for example, done more to sanction individuals, say, by fining them directly or by removing them from the industry? And, you know, we're all Americans in this discussion. You know, Americans ask these questions a lot. Why haven't bankers been held to account? I just want to get the perspective of you. You're coming at the industry a little bit recently, but you're coming from very relevant backgrounds, fraud, misconduct investigations. Jeff, you said you're a lawyer. You've had a lot of experience over a lot of different sectors. You've worked in the energy sector and so forth. Why is it so difficult to actually hold people to account?
Well, you packed a lot in there. Let me tease that apart, and if I may address different bits of that. Thanks for your kind comments about the compendium. It's an awful lot of work on our part to put that together, and we're very pleased to see that it's been well received as a document. We're particularly pleased that this year the compendium featured contributions from people who know a lot more about this than we do. And that $600 billion figure that you referenced is a case in point. it's funny, these figures tend to take a life of their own. Some consultancy will do a report, and they'll report that there's been $230 billion in fines since the financial crisis. Some journalists will pick that up and repeat it, and then it becomes an echo chamber. And so we start to see this $230, $240, $250 billion number being tossed around quite regularly in the popular press. And we've used that number ourselves. It's hard to know in the aggregate what these costs are. The Operational Risk Exchange, however, is a very interesting body. It's an industry entity that is made up of the heads of operational risk from most of the large financial institutions. And it's a give-to-get kind of an organization where the different heads of op risk agree that they'll contribute loss data, op risk loss data, with their peers on the condition that their peers do likewise. And then that data is aggregated and the results are shared. And it allows you to get some sort of sense of trends across the industry and allows you to benchmark yourself against others. And what's important about that number, it's actually $607 billion is the number they reported in November of last year, is that that's an industry-produced number, right? It's the industry's own data, and it aggregates up to over $600 billion. That number is mind-boggling. It's actually really hard to get your head around a number that large. So to put it into sort of a context that I find easier to grasp, and credit here to McKinsey for a report they produced, I believe it was earlier this year, where they said that the costs due to misconduct issues, so that's not just punitive fines, lawsuits and costs related to other legal activities, but also the increased spend on governance, risk and compliance, processes, systems, personnel. The cost over the last decade in the aggregate has reached an order of magnitude that equals or may even now exceed the total credit default losses that led to the financial crisis in the first place. And so that putting it in that context, I think, makes a different level of resonance, at least for me. In the financial crisis, those losses were quite acute. And here it's been more chronic, and maybe it's the chronic nature of it, like that frog that's in the boiling pot, right? Well, you don't notice it because the water is warming up slowly. But at a certain point, it does hit the boiling point, and I think we're there when it comes to these conduct costs.
Yeah. I would say that after the financial crisis, we saw regulator attention focused on what one would expect, which was the macroprudential issues and survivability of the system as a whole, and then there was sort of a natural shift to some of the microprudential, and let's look at institutions on their own and see how they would deal with various types of risks and or the processes in place for that. And what we've seen over the last few years, I think, is more of a focus on sort of cultural issues at the banks and some of the individual behavioral issues that you've mentioned. And that we have identified in the compendium. And so we started doing it a few years ago, and this is our second volume. And what we've seen is increasing attention globally to these types of cultural issues. And it in some ways, Glenn, your point about the number being both distressing but also nice to see as well, because it shows focus, I think holds true, that regulators, especially over the last few years, are paying more and more attention to behavioral issues, and banks, therefore, are paying more attention to it because the regulators are asking, but also because they recognize the importance of it. And we're starting to see over the last year that not just the questions being asked and the attention being paid to this, but also some answers that are starting to be put in place and some consensus among both regulators and institutions. And that does seem to also mean that some of those answers are a focus on individual accountability. And often in the United States, after the global financial crisis, people complained that bankers weren't put in jail or otherwise held accountable. And so there's the criminal question, but there's also just the responsibility question and outlining who is responsible for various issues and making sure that they actually understand that and that they hold themselves out as being responsible. And so what we've seen in many jurisdictions led by the UK and other places as well now are these individual accountability regimes that the banks have to identify their senior managers, what their senior managers are responsible for, and the regulator often has to approve those as well.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Last year, CSUN collaborated with the Financial Stability Institute's Hong Kong office and the Bank of Thailand on a seminar in corporate governance that focused on culture and conduct, you know, the issues, you know, that we're talking about today. And one of the presenters made the valuable point that empowering the supervisors to critically evaluate a firm's culture gave them an additional tool that had been previously lacking, the ability to do something when the examiners walk into a bank, like we've all done as bank examiners, and you just get the sense that something is clearly wrong at this bank. Even if there are no explicit violations of laws, regulations, best banking practices, and so forth. Now, in your view, what can the bank supervisors do or do more of to ensure that the findings of their culture and conduct reviews are taken seriously by boards and senior management of banks and lead to meaningful changes in culture throughout the organization, particularly if the banks say, well, we haven't done anything wrong yet, so why are you telling us that our culture needs to be fixed? You haven't cited any law violations. You know, our profitability seems strong. We're capital adequate. We have low non-performing assets and so forth. How can you tell us we're doing something wrong? How would you answer that? And how would you encourage bank supervisors to push boards to achieve the meaningful action?
Yeah, I think you touched on something very important there. it's good to hear that regulators view this culture issue as a tool in their supervisory handbag. My own sense of things is that while that may be a tool, it's a tool that people are very poorly trained in using. notwithstanding, of course, many firms, and for that matter, many regulators, think that this culture stuff is all very soft and squishy, and it's not really a matter for supervisory activity in the first place. But for those who do think that this is something important and something they want to make work for them, the challenge has been, how do you operationalize the idea that culture matters? Okay, we all agree culture matters, so what? Right? What do we do next? And can we even have a common taxonomy? What does culture mean? We talk about conduct risk. Well, what qualifies as conduct risk? Is cyber risk a conduct risk? Is conduct risk part of op risk? And so the taxonomy has not settled, and I think there's a broad lack of coherence around how do we operationalize this? What is this that we're talking about? We all agree it's important, but how do you progress the dialogue from there? And I think that what we have seen is the pioneering work that was done by the Dutch Central Bank has really inspired a lot of imitation among central banks elsewhere. And just in the last year, we've seen the Central Bank of Ireland doing culture and conduct audits of its banks. We've seen, of course, in Australia, the same approach has been adopted and elsewhere. So I think that there's an industry-wide push to try to think about how you operationalize this stuff. But there's, a challenge in terms of definition and taxonomy that has yet to be resolved. And then even if you do adopt approaches such as that the DNB has brought to bear, that's not very scalable, right? Their approach, for those of you who don't know it, is to send examiners in, and they do lots of detailed interviews with people. They'll actually sit in on board meetings, but it's a very human-driven process, and it's something that's very hard to scale across the global footprint of a G-SIFI. So that's where technology is a friend, and we can say more about that later. But Jeff, maybe you wanted to add something to that.
Yeah, I would just say in parallel to the supervisory focus on culture and conduct and bring the right tools to bear and whatever supervisory approach is most effective, you also need the regulated entity to recognize that this stuff is important and has real life consequences and just isn't something in the abstract. And I think we're starting to see that more and more. The firms still have the same issues they need to deal with about how do you measure it, and is it scalable and everything else. But at least in terms of recognizing that culture does matter, I think there's more. And there's been examples that we've seen, whether it's in the United States with Wells Fargo or other places, where people have lost their jobs. The CEOs, they've gone through two CEOs since the misconduct came to light, and significant fines and valuations and everything else. And I think as leadership begins to recognize that, and it permeates throughout the organization, that we'll see more and more attention to these issues.
Mm-hmm. Very good. I think that regulators and supervisors, they already have the structure. They already have the structure for educating, training, you know, raising awareness, if you will, of bank directors and senior officers. Most of the major regulators around the world already have that infrastructure. It seems like they just have to start using it more and get out there and tell the bank boards, you know, collectively bring all the directors together and say, we are going to focus on this, and we are going to hold you to account if we, you know, see deficiencies in culture that provide a ripe environment for misconduct to occur. As you point out in the compendium, there have been many laudable efforts by financial sector standard setters, such as the Financial Stability Board and various supervisory authorities over the last few years, to describe this common enabling cultural environment in which bank misconduct seems to be more prevalent. The compendium mentions a few examples of that: a lack of diversity on boards and senior management, domineering or authoritarian leadership styles, a relentless pursuit of short-term profits, a disregard of the tone from the top by middle management, an atmosphere of psychological fear, pressure. Employees are afraid to speak up. They're afraid to challenge bad practices that they see. A lack of corrective action when problems are pointed out internally, let's say by the employees, or externally by the regulators or other stakeholders. I realize that working with financial institutions is kind of new. You know, you have been doing it for 2-3 years. But in your work, have you already come across examples of financial institutions that have tried to change, that have tried to meaningfully adjust their culture without necessarily changing the people in charge, you know, working with the same boards, the same senior management, but they get it. They realize that they do need to change, and they have made efforts to do so.
Yeah, I think it's important to identify two different drivers of this agenda. One is, as Jeff's pointed out, that regulators now around the world seem to have a consensus view that culture is important, and they have the view that culture is important for a reason. It's important because it is the culture of a firm that drives the behavior of its people, and because regulators are tasked with supervising conduct. If in fact culture is a precursor to conduct, then there's a duty to sort of get out in front of things and have a look at the culture in that regard. And because of that regulatory attention, firms are starting to take this more seriously. And as more and more senior leaders are being held to account, we'll see more of that, as Jeff just noted. But another big driver, and perhaps a larger driver, is that budgets for governance, risk, and compliance-related activities, systems, processes, people, are just so bloated that they're no longer sustainable. The costs related to governance, risk, and compliance are now so large that it's just savaging ROE ratios for the firms. And so there's a real impetus on the part of firms to figure out how can we cut those costs. But of course, you dare not do that, because if something does go wrong amidst declining investment in the sort of non-financial risk management, you can rightly fear, you know, crucifixion by your regulator, right? So the firms are trying to figure out how they themselves become more effective, more efficient, more timely. And they're looking at predictive analytics as holding real promise in that regard by distilling signal from the data that the firms already collect and have sitting there. There's diamonds to be found in that dust. And if you have an artificial intelligence tool that can sift through the noise and distill the nuggets that are useful and actionable, then that holds the promise of creating greater efficiency, greater effectiveness, greater timeliness, and positioning firms to be proactive about these risks. And we're seeing a lot of regulators now warm to that idea as well. To your specific question of particular firms engaging this, confidentiality requirements are such that we have to be a little circumspect in this regard. But we've just concluded a pilot project with a large global bank, and they were looking at the use of technologies like ours, and I'm sure they're working with others also, where there was an opportunity to look at the functioning of their three lines of defense and ask whether or not it was functioning as hoped. And could data technologies provide insights into what is, for this particular institution, a really significant operation that spans the globe? It's the bank has quite a global footprint. And so how do you get your arms around all of that? How do you get a God's eye view on just that non-financial risk management function? And how can you ask and then answer intelligent questions around, is it functioning as we intend? You brought out the point earlier that it's not just the formal org chart that really reflects how an organization operates. Rather, it's the company behind the chart. And for us at Starling, that company behind the chart is represented by the trust relationships among different people. And those trust relationships will shape behavioral dynamics in ways that are predictable. And our technology allows us to see some of that. So firms have shown real interest in that and are starting to experiment with it. But the we're a young company, and this is new, right? So the jury's out.
Yeah, and one of the points that you made, Glenn, was about the speak up culture and how important that is for firms to try to encourage. And then it's often a way that regulators, when they're looking at a firm, try to assess how things are going by looking and trying to understand how much of that speak up has actually been occurring. And one of the things that we found interesting in our projects is that speak up culture is something that takes root and is encouraged when you have certain types of relationships, trusting relationships among the various people on the risk teams or other employees at the bank. And so if one is able to measure some of those relationships and get an understanding of those relationships, then one can be even more predictive about whether you're going to have an effective speak-up culture, and you're not just trying to measure it by how many times someone has called the whistleblower hotline or something like that, which is an after-the-fact measurement. You can try to be more understanding of what's really going on in the organization and therefore be more effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just add that's true for diversity as well. There's a real pressure to increase, particularly gender diversity, to increase the number of women represented in the financial services sector. But just hiring more women doesn't create diversity. It allows you to offer statistics that suggest that you're improving because we used to have only 24% female employees and now we have 30%, so that must mean we're better. But if you can actually study the trust relationships within an organization, if you can graph things out and see that most of those women are pushed out to the periphery, right? Think of the female engineers at Uber. They weren't really brought into the fabric of the organization, right? They weren't in the belly of the bank. And if that's the case, then what you have is something that masquerades as real diversity, but in fact shows no inclusion. And that will also contribute to the speak-up culture issue as well. People become galvanized into little factions. And so using technology to try to sift some of that stuff out is something that a number of folks find interesting.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about your technology and how it works to identify the trust relationships and how it can be used to for example, describe the culture of a bank and say, well, Bank A, you know, is a little bit different from Bank B. I'm asking this because there are a lot of skeptics out there who will say that, you know, something like trust cannot be measured. Something like culture, you know, cannot be described with data. And answer that for me.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, the central question to all of this. You know, the formulation from the regulators is that culture drives conduct. The pushback from firms is that, you know, culture is soft and squishy, and it can't be measured. And of course, if it can't be measured, it can't be managed. And if culture, in fact, drives conduct, then what you're saying is that conduct can't be managed. And that formulation is just no longer being permitted to stand. But how do you get concrete and data-driven around this stuff is your question, and it's one that we hear often from others. There's a long conversation to be had around that that we won't have time for today, but I would suggest this. For us at Starling, culture, in a sense, almost doesn't matter, except in how it matters. And it matters in as much as culture sets norms of behavior in an organization. And those norms of behavior are reflected concretely in behavior. And behavior is observable. And those behavioral tendencies are derivative of relationships. Relationships are also reflected in communication patterns in an organization. And there's an awful lot of data. Just think of email, let alone chat and digital phone records and, you know, countless other forms of communication that are digital in nature, which produce data. And in that data are artifacts that reflect the relationships within an organization. And those relationships, in turn, shape behaviors. And so you have an ability to start piecing things together and to plug them into cleverly designed artificial intelligence engines and distill patterns in that electronic communications data that ties with predictive reliability to behavioral outcomes. And so that now starts to make cultural predilections tangible in a way that is tied very concretely to specific behavior that management is interested in. So in broad brushstrokes, that's how our technology works. I'll pause. Jeff, did you want to add something to that?
I would just say that it's legitimate for someone to ask a question about, hey, can you measure culture? I mean, that's understandable. But what's also important to keep in mind is that there may be different answers depending on what you're looking at within the organization, and it's not always the case that the culture of that there's one culture within an entire organization. There may be different pieces of the organization that have different types of culture, which may lead to different types of behaviors. Moreover, what we're trying to do is not to say you have a good culture or a bad culture, to try to use those types of adjectives in describing culture. What we're saying or looking at is, what is this culture? Is it a culture where people have high trust relationships, where directives that are put in place from senior management actually filter throughout the organization? Is it that type of culture? Is it the kind of culture where people are willing to speak up or challenge each other? And based on those types of views of the culture, then it's going to lead to certain types of behaviors which are measurable and which have real business outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it occurs to me as Jeff speaking, we're not coming in and trying to codify culture. We're not looking to identify culture codes in the organization. We're looking to identify cultural consequence. And then let the firms sort of look at that and then backstep and say, well, if we're seeing signals that show that there's a cultural predilection that predictably leads to certain behaviors, can we get out in front of that? And can we steer the organization in a more desirable direction?
Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, you know, that, you know, just as you said, Stephen, a few minutes ago, it seems to me that firms would naturally gravitate towards some type of solution that would help them cut down on a lot of these compliance costs that are so manual and so painful, you know, to gather the information and, you know, do all of the employee surveys, all of the training programs and everything that require an enormous amount of labor effort. I think you rightly said, you know, that with compliance costs sort of heavily weighing down on firms, we have all of the other pressures that are heavily weighing down on banks these days. I know from the standpoint of a prudential supervisor, you know, we're talking about profitability being squeezed because of the ultra low level of interest rates. We're talking about fintech competitors coming in and gobbling up profitable bits of a bank's operations. You know, so the burdens on the banks are growing in terms of compliance, and the costs are growing, while at the same time, other sources of profits are shrinking. You know, so I can sense, you know, that there is this kind of growing imperative that we have to get to the bottom of this in an efficient way. And so I think that the investments in technological solutions or reg tech or, you know, big data solutions or whatever you want to call them will clearly pay off in the long run. I'm curious about behavioral science. It sounds like neither of you were trained as behavioral sciences, but in your previous careers, you know, you have absorbed many of the observations and viewed a lot of the patterns that behavioral scientists would identify and use in their work. Could you perhaps name like one or two tools of modern behavioral science that would show promise in the identification of a potentially enabling environment for misconduct to occur at a bank?
There's a lot to point out there. I'll point at two things. We've talked a lot during our remarks during this podcast, Mark, on how we think trust is an important thing. There's a woman at Harvard Business School, Amy Edmondson, who's known for work that she's done on a topic called psychological safety. And to be transparent, she makes a distinction between trust and psychological safety. But psychological safety works to create an environment in which people feel free to speak up and to dissent. And culture, as we think about it, operates to create normative constraints on people. This is the sort of place where one must ... or one mustn't ... And when those cultural norms, when those cultural rules have been deeply inculcated, dissenting from those rules is individually quite threatening. You stick your head up over the parapet and it gets shot off. And so as a consequence, groupthink tends to prevail. People who know information that's important to share keep it to themselves. And so Amy Edmondson points to psychological safety as creating the conditions that permit people to dissent from what I think are these coercive norms of the organization in a way that benefits everyone. And so that's a topic that is one I would encourage listeners to have a close look at. The Financial Conduct Authority in the UK references quite directly Amy Edmondson's work in some of the recent publications that they've produced on this topic of culture and conduct risk management. So those ideas from the behavioral sciences are starting to seep into the conduct regulators dialogue and the prudential regulators dialogue. A second piece of behavioral science that I think is important, and it's one that we emphasize, is that behavior is contagious. And we have a terrific advisor to our business, Nicholas Christakis, who's at Yale. He leads the Yale Human Nature Lab. And Nicholas has done tremendous work looking at a whole range of behavioral outcomes that are driven by social network dynamics. One that he's recently known for is work on obesity. If your friends are obese, I forget the precise statistics, but you're 50% more likely to be obese yourself. If your friends' friends are obese, you're 35% more likely to be obese yourself. And if your friends' friends' friends, people who you may not know even exist in the world, but if they are obese, then you'll also have a tendency towards obesity. And that sort of beggars credibility. It's hard to understand how that could be. How is it that people I don't even know could affect my behavior? And yet there's countless examples of that. And Nicholas has some terrific TED Talks where he describes some of this work. In the context of the work that we do, we're looking at behavior in an organization, and we're arguing that it is contagious. And if that's true, then we have a very rich field of science called epidemiological studies, right? That's been very well established to be quite effective in directing the World Health Organization and the CDC and, you know, other national health bodies to understand how a particular pathogen is moving through a population, to track the spread of that pathogen, and most importantly, to forecast how that pathogen is going to continue to spread. And that then informs you, where do we need to place our limited inoculation resources in order to try to halt the spread of this virus? And in a very similar way, the technologies that we bring to market, coupled with this behavioral science idea of behavior being contagious, allows the analytic outputs that we generate to position firms to become much more efficient in where they apply those limited financial risk management or non-financial risk management resources in order to stop the spread of a behavior that is deleterious to the firm's interests. Or conversely, knowledge sharing across your three lines of defense, for instance, encouraging behavior that makes performance for the organization more successful.
Very good. And it kind of brings to mind, when you talked about behavior being contagious, it kind of brings to mind a previous CSIN policy summit 2 years ago in 2017, when we had a gentleman come and speak whose name is Richard Bowen, and he was a former top official at Citibank working in the mortgage area. And he is now on the lecture circuit. He's semi-retired. And he is one of the founders of a group called Bank Whistleblowers United. And he made that exact same point, that when he observed misconduct going on at the financial institution that he was involved in, it was almost like the behavior sunk to the least common denominator, that otherwise ethical and well-behaving people, when they were around those who wanted to cut corners and in the case of this particular bank, sell lousy mortgages into the secondary market, mortgages that the bank itself would never keep, and yet in their representations and warranties say that they were, you know, relatively standard mortgages, that the conduct just sank down to almost a gutter level, and that perpetuated massive amounts of misconduct at this institution. So this is now, what you just mentioned is going to, I think, resonate with not only bank supervisors, but also bankers who have worked at institutions where the general level of respect for laws, regulations, best banking practices have deteriorated.
Yeah, I think we haven't ourselves seen significant evidence at this point that the heads of risk committees on boards at banks have discovered that this category of technology and that this set of capabilities exists. I think once that information percolates through that community, you'll have risk committees asking senior leadership of firms awkward questions like, what are we doing around this sort of stuff? Are we not doing this sort of stuff? In fact, the Australian regulators quite recently made the comment that RegTech holds real promise, not just in the culture and conduct context, but for other regulatory concerns as well. And they're taking an approach with the banks that they oversee and saying, you either need to be experimenting with RegTech or you better have a good reason to explain why not. So I think we're at sort of a threshold here in the industry where different folks are looking at different ways of addressing old problems. And in this regard, I often think of the quote by the German physicist Max Planck. He said, you know, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And I think that's what we'll be seeing soon.
Okay. And I often think of a quote in this context of years ago when I was a high school debater, and I was challenging somebody from the opposing team, and I was saying, you know, you simply are asking us to measure something, you know, that can't be measured. And I asked her, how can you measure love? And she said, by the number of kisses he gives me. So things are measurable and things are quantifiable that we didn't think were the case in the past. We're out of time now, gentlemen, but I just wanted to give you the opportunity to give us any concluding thoughts before we switch off.
I don't know that I have anything particularly brilliant to conclude with. I just say that it's a real delight for us to have the opportunity to engage with the CSEN Center. For Jeff and me running a startup with these cockamamie ideas that we think have real value, when all of a sudden people such as yourselves start to take this sort of stuff seriously and say, maybe these guys are onto something, that's a real tonic for us. So we really appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Stephen and Jeff, for coming in and spending the time with us and with our listeners today. I would also like to announce to our listeners, or perhaps remind them, that in the middle of October this year, hosted by Bank of Thailand, CSEN will be running a seminar on big data, RegTech, and SoupTech. And we hope to have not only regulators, but also industry practitioners present. We want to show the regulators that actual solutions are out there to some of the problems that are faced. Thanks to you again, and thanks to the all the listeners out there who have shown great receptivity to our podcast over the past year, and we're really grateful to that. So thank you to everybody, and have a pleasant day.